ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, time for Nightlife News Breakdown. After a marathon 5-hour Liberal Party room meeting on net zero climate policy, no new policy or decisions have been made. Rather, those announcements apparently will come tomorrow. On leaving the meeting, Coalition leader Susan Lee had this to say to the understandably eager media throng.
Shortly, and the Shadow Ministry will convene tomorrow to resolve our final position, but it was an excellent meeting and terrific to hear from all of my Liberal Party colleagues.
Is your party united, Ms Lee?
Well, subsequently, Shadow Energy Minister Dan Tehan made a statement to the press saying there'd been very, very passionate discussions in the room, and he outlined what would happen now.
What will follow after today is that I will prepare a submission that will go to the Shadow Ministry at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and then myself and Susan will stand up after that Shadow Ministry and formally announce our policy. And that policy will have come out of that very robust and rigorous process.
He also described what he said were the party's guiding principles as to how the policy will be arrived at.
Energy affordability must come first and must be the focus along with reliability. And then the second principle is that we have to be serious when it comes to addressing emissions reduction.
Now, apparently all 57 elected members of the Federal Liberal Party were invited to speak in the meeting. That's House of Reps and Senate, speaking in alphabetical order. There was also a presentation on polling analysis by the party's Federal Director, Andrew Hirst, to put into electoral context what dumping net zero by 2050 might mean on voter perceptions. Well, joining us tonight for the news breakdown, Ron Mizen, political correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. Ron, good evening. Welcome back.
Good evening, Philip. Good to be back.
Gee, it's akin to the election of a new pope, isn't it? I mean, do they have a white smoke, black smoke thing going on? White smoke, we've got a policy. Black smoke, still no policy.
Not quite. It's probably just as many factions, though. It's certainly a pretty landmark day for the Liberal Party. You know, as you mentioned, everyone was given the opportunity to speak. 49 people all up. Expressed a view, but the numbers that we got at the end of the meeting suggested that it was pretty clear that about close to 60%, 28 of the 49 people that stood up and spoke were for dumping net zero, while 17 advocated for keeping it, and some others sort of spoke in an ambiguous way. And the leader, Susan Lee and Dan Tehan, didn't give their views. They sort of left it to the party room. But yes, it looks like the policy that the Liberals announced tomorrow after their shadow cabinet meeting will certainly abandon net zero.
Did Andrew Hirst, he apparently spelled out what the polling says about the risk of dumping a policy. What do we know about what he said?
Yeah, certainly. It was quite a long presentation from the Federal Liberal Director, Andrew Hirst. They've done a lot of research into this. Our understanding is that it outlined very clearly that certainly in the minds of a lot of people, Gen Z voters, millennial voters, and even Generation X voters, that the phrase net zero is largely associated with action on climate, and that repudiating it is effectively a position that you don't believe in climate change. That's a significant risk that Hirst outlined to the party room. He also outlined some possible political pathways forward for them. If you're able to sort of, in the minds of voters, link that net zero to cost of living and energy costs and energy insecurity, then there's an opportunity to be able to leverage that. And certainly we understand that, for example, Alex Hawke, who is one of Susan Lee's closest allies, made the argument that Gen Z and millennial voters cared more about housing costs than climate change at this stage. So these are the kinds of arguments that we were hearing being put forward and that were being considered. But look, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people had a very strong position against net zero, regardless of what the polling said. And I think the numbers at the end of the day probably reflect that as well.
Yes, the question is, if not that, what? After the election, there did seem to be some shift, didn't they, that the policies Peter Dutton was taking to voters on energy were not seen as not electorally appealing, but now the Nationals, and it seems from what you're saying tomorrow, the Liberals certainly too, will abandon net zero and start talking again about coal and gas and indeed nuclear. These are ideas yeah that really were rehearsed in the last election and were pretty soundly rejected. What's the strategy here, do you think?
Look, I think the party is looking for a very clear distinction and differentiation amongst the electorate with the Labor Party. They're looking for that fight that they can have, that they can stand up every single day and, you know, blame net zero and blame Labor's energy policy on rising power bills, on, you know, industrial smelters going out of action, on small businesses going closed because they can't afford the power bills. They can sort of, it gives them this sort of touchstone of which they can draw all of these other problems in the economy back to and then prosecute their case. So I think that's probably partially the reason why they're pursuing that. Of course, once the Nationals also abandoned net zero, you know, it made it a lot easier for a whole bunch of the national right of the Liberal Party to pursue this approach. Of course, there are a lot in the moderate wing of the party, those who are particularly around inner city seats, not even inner city seats, suburban seats generally, where the Liberal Party was decimated at the last election, who spoke out against this change and said that it would, you know, effectively cost them those seats much longer than they needed to, potentially indefinitely. Certainly part of the reason we saw the teal wave in the 2022 election and we saw that maintained was a lot to do with climate change and energy. But you're right, the next question is, what does their policy actually look like? Some early debate that we're seeing suggests that, yes, coal and gas will be a much greater part of the mix. There's been talk of from Angus Taylor of sweating coal longer, so making those coal-fired power stations last much longer into this century. And, of course, there's also an argument around nuclear. It doesn't appear that there's a strong view in favour of having the Dutton-style nuclear policy where the government is paying significant amounts of money to build nuclear power plants. It sounds more like that they just want to lift the moratorium on nuclear and allow the market to decide whether there's a place for it. On the contrary to that, though, there is also talk now of including coal and gas in the capacity investment scheme. Now, that's the program that the government implemented to basically guarantee a revenue base for renewable energy projects. And that's one of Chris Bowen's signature policies, and the Liberal Party is now talking about adding coal and gas into that. So you could see under them a policy where taxpayers are underwriting revenue for coal and gas power plants.
Who would build these coal plants? This is the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
No private investor is going to do it, so who's going to
do it? I think we've heard talk, I mean, to the extent that we don't know what the final policy outline looks like, but I think there has been talk of, you know, possible government intervention even in the coal space and governments owning coal or potentially extending them. But you're right, who will ultimately own these assets or build these new assets is very unclear. But at the same time, we're probably not going to have to worry about it too much for potentially
true
5 or 6 years because, you know, it's unlikely that the coalition, short of a disaster for Labor, will win the next election. So there's at least 5 or 6 years, and it's possible that the environment that we have, the energy space that we have now, will look very different then. That said, part of the equation that the coalition is thinking about here is that by 2028, it is likely that it will be clear that Labor will fall short of its 2030 emissions reduction targets. And that then creates the space for them to again argue, well, we've done all of this work, this cost has come, and we're still not going to reach those targets, at least not on the current trajectory. So there is politics at play here in terms of the strategy that they're adopting.
Okay, there was a lot of talk about this whole issue of abandoning net zero causing problems for Susan Lee, because after all, she believes in net zero, or has in the past. And there's lots of talk about this would threaten her leadership because tomorrow she's basically got to come out and say, well, I'm leading a policy which I personally don't believe in. How did today's meeting go on that score in the terms of test of leadership?
I think there's probably two clear elements to this. The first is that the agitators within the party who really don't like Susan Lee, even some of them have said that there is a distinction between this net zero debate and her leadership. They think that she will survive certainly into next year and the future of her leadership will depend more on what happens with the polls next year. That said, there was a really interesting moment today when all of the members of parliament were heading towards the party room to have this debate. You know, the moderates and Susan Lee and others all walked in sort of, you know, dribs and drabs independently or with others. The National Right, that sort of hardcore faction that wanted to dump net zero, the likes of Jacinta Namba-Jimpa-Price, Angus Taylor, Andrew Hastie and others, all walked in together showing, you know, with a big show on force, and that sent a very clear message, I think, that, you know, that was a message to the public, but it was also a message to Susan Lee on leadership. And so, you know, I think the end of last week, the general consensus in the parliamentary press gallery was that there's a countdown clock on Susan Lee's leadership now. I'm not sure much today has changed that.
No. All right, one potential future leader did make some comments to the press post-meeting following the five-hour meeting. Backbencher Andrew Hastie went for a jog and spoke to the ABC on his way back into Parliament House.
We worked through lunch, so I had no energy, and I tanked at about 3Ks, and that's exactly what's going to happen to the Australian economy if we continue with Labor's net zero, which is why I argued for cheap, abundant energy today and for scrapping net zero.
Yeah, sounds like he was running on net zero too there, Ron. Maybe life
he's
is a
former SAS soldier and he's struggling to get to 3Ks.
I was going to say 3Ks is not exactly, I mean, it's not exactly an onerous.
Well, it's tough being a politician.
Maybe. All right, anyway, but just to make sure that this this long-running feature film is not over yet, we're supposed to get an announcement tomorrow, are we? But then again, there's further meetings after that, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. So I think the next step is for the Shadow Ministry to approve a policy position on this. Whether that's a full and complete policy or whether it's just some principles remains to be seen. But then, of course, that then needs to go to the full Liberal Party room again to be formally adopted. And then it needs to be reconciled with the National Party position as well so that there is a unified coalition position. But certainly if the, you know, if the Liberal Party has dumped net zero, full stop, then that's pretty unified with what the Nationals did. So, yeah, we'll wait and see, but there's a few steps to go.
Yes, which tail is wagging which dog? All right. Australia and Indonesia will deepen their defence relationship. This was a surprise today, wasn't it? Standing alongside Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto, who's on his first official visit to Australia since becoming president of Indonesia, the Prime Minister announced that Australia and Indonesia will deepen their defence relationship as part of a new security agreement. So this new treaty is based on an earlier one signed by Paul Keating and President Suharto nearly 30 years ago. Mr Albanese sees it as a watershed moment.
This treaty will commit Australia and Indonesia to consult at a leader and ministerial level on a regular basis on matters of security, to identify and undertake mutually beneficial security activities, and if either or both countries' security is threatened, to consult and consider what measures may be taken, either individually or jointly, to deal with those threats. This is a watershed moment in the Australia-Indonesia relationship.
Ron, how significant is this?
Yeah, look, it's pretty important. This was work that began and significantly advanced when Prime Minister Anthony Albanese visited Indonesia soon after the May election. He made a point that this was the first overseas trip that he made. He had a very warm reception from the President Prabowo then. I was fortunate enough to be on that trip, and that warmth was very, very clear in the relationship there. This is I think Albanese has had a really strong few months in terms of locking in significant wins in international relations. You know, we've seen him overseas almost constantly for the past few months, whether that be in Canada, whether that be in Washington, whether that be in, you know, Jakarta, or recently in South Korea and Malaysia. And then, of course, he's got the G20 coming up in Johannesburg as well. So, you know, he's been all over the world. He's been locking in these agreements. And Indonesia, you know, the Indonesian president makes the comment here that you can sort of choose your friends, but you can't choose your neighbours. I think he's part of Indonesia's strategy here is to continue to build close ties with Australia, because ultimately, at the end of the day, we are in the same region. We are, you know, each other's biggest neighbours, and there is important defence and national security ties that come with that. But of course, at the same time, Indonesia is a BRICS country. It has a very strong policy of connection. I'm not using the right phrase there, but their position is basically they're everybody's friends, so they are part of that BRICS alliance.
They're not aligned. That's right. Exactly.
Non-aligned. That's the word. That is still central to their relationship, and that was also very forcefully put today as well. You know, it's important that Indonesia policy remains as is.
Yep, well, treaties are better than saber-rattling any day of the week, I would imagine. All right, now, what's happening with the COP meeting, Ron? The COP meeting's on at Brazil at the moment. Mr. Albanese hasn't gone there. But we're in a bare-knuckle fight with Turkey to host the meeting next year, which is supposed to be in Adelaide, but Turkey wants it. The wife of Turkey's First Lady, the wife of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan is a long-time environmental campaigner, is apparently behind it. If there's no agreement, it goes to Germany, and no one seems to want that. What's the story? Are we ahead here or not, or is it we're not going to get it?
The problem that we have is that to get the COP under the existing process, it's a all-or-nothing situation. So you need to get all of the individual countries to agree on a country hosting it, and even one or two dissenters stops that decision from being made. And if a decision is not made, then it does revert to a previous host nation. In this case, that'll go to, as you know, Germany there. There is a COP summit in Brazil at the moment, and it is notable that amid all of this international travel that Anthony Albanese is doing, he hasn't gone to that COP summit. He hasn't sort of gone to advocate, which suggests that they don't see much value in going there, and they don't think it's going to turn the tide on being able to access this. But certainly what we understand, and my colleague Philip Curry's been doing a little reporting on this lately, the cost of hosting that COP summit next year in Adelaide is really, really significant. It's somewhere between $1.3 billion and $2 billion, depending on the size of how it's done. And that's, of course, done in consultation with the Pacific, who would be co-hosting it with Australia.
Surely Adelaide caravan parks can't cost that much, right?
Well, yeah, there's a lot more to it, but we're talking tens of thousands of people here potentially coming into Adelaide. And that then you have the security costs on top of that. We know the police forces around the country have been asked to think about what police they can supply to the COP summit to help them. So a really significant cost. And our understanding is that while nobody is necessarily, hoping that the whole COP bid fails, many in the cabinet would not be unhappy.
would not be unhappy if it did fail,
given the cost.
No, given the cost, exactly. All right, just finally, you've been following this bureaucratic innovation, public service AI, where federal public servants will get access to a ChatGPT-style AI engine from next year. And big swathes of government data will be allowed to be uploaded to public AI platforms. Hello? Are we hearing robo-debt here or not? What are we hearing?
Yeah, so it's quite remarkable, actually. A year ago we were talking about really strict guide rails for AI. The government was going to implement this big AI policy to, to crack down on its use and make sure that there weren't negative consequences. After the election, we know that Ed Husic ceased to be industry minister and the government's taken a whole different approach. It's basically just saying, let it rip. We want AI everywhere. We need to adopt it. We need it for productivity. And they're taking a very light touch approach. And that approach is now being transferred into the federal public service. The finance minister, Katie Gallagher, today announced that basically the government would implement a ChatGPT style AI, as you mentioned, known as GovAI Chat, which will be available on every public service laptop from 2026. And they also just want to see AI adopted tools adopted all across the public service. And even to the point where they're basically going to allow some public AIs like ChatGPT, like Gemini or Copilot to be used with government data up to a certain classification. So a really significant step change, and it kind of shows you, it's not just big companies that are doing this, it's happening everywhere in terms of that AI adoption.
Yeah, it is. It is, Ron. May we outlive it? No, we won't. That's true.
Ron, well, it was actually a really good story, I would add, in I'm trying to remember who it was. The Crikey today actually had this good story, an FOI about the artificial intelligent chat logs that the Australia's chief spy has with their co-pilot. And they were able to get that information under Freedom of Information and see that, even Australia's chief spy is using it to develop, response or correspondence with people and speech notes. So everybody's using it.
Everybody's using it. Exactly. Yes, I know. I wonder whether the coalition party is using it to develop a new energy policy.
It might help Angus Taylor get that. It might help Dan Tehan get that policy document written well before bedtime.
That's true. He's got a busy night by the sound of it. All right, Ron. Good to talk as always. Thank you.
Good to be back. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.